This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. On today's Trumpet Hour, our panel of trumpet writers is ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also in Edstone, Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Good to be with you.
We are seeing one of the most stunning reversals of history take place right before our eyes. The dominant trend in the last couple hundred years, especially the last half century, has been the rise of democratic free societies led first by the British Empire, then the American superpower. And it seemed like freedom was on the march. The world was going to go more and more toward these democratic governments, and freedom would reign. But biblical prophecy said something very different. It foretold a time when the world would actually revert to the strong nationalism, arms races, authoritarianism, dictatorships, a much darker, more barbaric time. Well, thankfully, it'll only be for a short time, but essentially, the age of man is prophesied to climax in what the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles, with strong man rule being the dominant force among nations. Now it's becoming clearer and clearer that this is exactly what's happening. We're moving rapidly into that time. You can see it happening in nation after nation, region by region, and really it's happening exactly as Bible prophecy said it would. It's going to intensify, but this is definitely the trend that we see happening today. We're going to lead off the show today with a couple stories that show this trend, one in Asia, the other in Europe. First, China. We talked about this on Wednesday's program, but just to catch you up to speed in case you missed it, this Asian giant, the world's most populous nation, looks like it has essentially entered a new strongman era. President Xi Jinping has cemented his control and his political power in a way that will shape China's policy, including its military and foreign policy, for years to come. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Chinese Communist Party's 19th National Congress just ended on Tuesday, but a new era for China has just begun. This is a new era that, as you said, it places President Xi Jinping in a staggeringly powerful leadership position. It gives him more control than almost all of his predecessors have had. And with this power, he'll be able to steer China more efficiently and with just redoubled intensity to accomplish all of the same goals that we saw him working toward in his first 5 years. And there's plenty of reason also to believe that Mr. Xi is now in a position to rule China for as long as he wants to. So one of the biggest developments from this party congress was that the Chinese Communist Constitution was revised to include Xi Jinping's personal ideology with his name right there beside those additions. And this is a really rare event. Both of Mr. Xi's immediate predecessors, Hu Jintao and Xing Zemin, they both made contributions to the Chinese Communist Party's constitution, but neither of them had their names etched into the document. And then even Deng Xiaoping, who opened up China to the world in the 70s and 80s, just a highly revered leader, even his contributions to the Constitution were not named after him while he was in power. It was only after his death in 1997 that his name was added. So that leaves Xi in the company of just one man, and that is Mao Zedong, the only other sitting leader to have his name and ideology written into the Constitution while he was, you know, in power, was Chairman Mao, the founder of the People's Republic of China back in 1949, and the man who led with an iron grip, with just full and brutal authoritarianism, right up until his death in 1976. So Xi's name and ideology being written into it really does elevate the current president of China up to the same level, up to the same status as Chairman Mao. And the significance of that, I think, cannot really be overstated.
So what is Xi thought? What is he espousing here, and what kind of power does this give him?
Well, his ideology is officially called Xi Jinping Thought on Socialism with Chinese Characteristics in a New Era.
That's catchy.
It's very catchy. 13 words in English, 16 characters in Chinese. The phrase sounds clunky, it sounds opaque, but it's saturated with a lot of significance. The foundational message of Xi Thought is that China must continue its rise and become the dominant world power. During Xi's first 5 years in office, this goal had already seen him focus on, three main things: muzzling dissent there in China, boosting China's military power, and then earning Beijing a larger role in international affairs. So now that his ideas are officially enshrined in the Constitution, he'll be able to push toward those same three goals with redoubled intensity. And also included in the revisions were several of Xi's core policy initiatives, including his Belt and Road plan to build infrastructure that links China to Europe, and his desire to boost government control in China's economy.
All right, we'll put this in prophetic context for us. We've been talking about this, all of these strongman prophecies. What are we looking at in Asia?
Well, one huge aspect of this is that typically just before the National Congress starts, the current president would unveil who his predecessor will be. And Xi neglected to do that. And in fact, he stacked the Politburo committee, the standing committee there, with men who are 60 years old or older, meaning none of them would really be eligible to even go on for a second five-year term. So basically this means that he is not naming a successor, and it looks very clearly like he will continue to rule beyond 2022, when he was supposed to retire. And so that does, it shows that this is the rise of the times of the Gentiles, just as you spoke about in the introduction there. The trumpet watches Xi Jinping's tightening grip on power, because Bible prophecy says, as America's influence continues to decline on the international stage, there will be two power blocks that emerge in its place. One is the European power that we watch so closely, and the other is an Asian conglomerate called in scriptures the Kings of the East. And it's headed by Russia, but it would have China in a secondary leadership position at its helm. If you look at Ezekiel 38 and verse 2, it talks about the land of Magog being a huge part of this Kings of the East power block. And that refers to the area that is modern-day China. And the Bible makes plain in many chapters, Daniel 11, Jeremiah 50, Revelation 16, that a clash between the European power and this Russo-Chinese-led Asian conglomerate will culminate in the most violent conflict in mankind's history. So as we see Xi Jinping continuing to boost his control over China's military and every aspect of the government, it just sort of shows how the Chinese president could fall in line with his fellow strongman there in Russia. And it shows how China can be brought onto its prophesied collision course with Europe. And I think it also just shows how near that clash, that World War III clash, really is.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing the Bible uses the term king, which obviously that is that's a title that's been around for a long time. But when it says Kings of the East and it talks about a European power that's led by 10 kings, and we're seeing these singular personalities rising up and dominating politics in a way that really is unusual, considering the way that history has been going for quite some time. But we're moving more in that direction. We see it in Russia. We're seeing it in China, Japan, and in other European countries in a way that's quite striking. If people wanted more information to put this in context, it seems like Russia and China in Prophecy would certainly be a very important and helpful booklet to look at, because it does talk a lot about China specifically and how it's put itself in a position to be able to be as dominant in the world as we see it today. Any other literature that might be helpful to our listeners?
Yeah, I think Russia and China in Prophecy would probably be the best one. There's also an even newer booklet that Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And of course, that's mostly about Vladimir Putin and Russia and how it will lead this end time power block. But it also talks quite a bit about how without China lending its power to Russia under a strongman such as Xi Jinping, it couldn't really happen. So both of those booklets would be excellent to put it all in the context of Bible prophecy.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We'll move now over to Europe, specifically the Czech Republic. Not quite as dramatic as what's happening there in China, but a strong illustration of the same trend. The Czechs voted this past Sunday and handed quite a sizable victory to a man who has been compared with anti-establishment, strongman, populist leaders like Donald Trump, former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. This follows similar earth-shaking election results in other European nations. For this story, we'll turn to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel like a bit of a broken record. It's a different country,
same
story.
Yeah.
You've got another individual and really whole political party that's kind of come from nowhere. His party was only established in 2011. And, you know, this Andrej Babiš that we're talking about, and his new party, they won 30% of the vote, which doesn't sound all that impressive until you realize that his nearest rival, I think, was around 11% of the vote.
So this is a very fragmented political situation in the Czech Republic. 30% is a big deal.
Yeah, he stands head and shoulders above anywhere else. The previous main party, they're all the way down to, I think, about 7% now. So you're just seeing a political system that is disintegrating. You're seeing people voting for a strongman. You're seeing complete dissatisfaction at the standard ways of doing things, the normal political parties. Everything that we've been talking about, well, for 5 years or more, but more and more often just over the last few months.
Yeah. So tell us about Babiš, what sort of policies he represents.
His big appeal to his voters is that they say that he is anti-corruption and he'll fight corruption. The big accusation from his detractors is that he's thoroughly corrupt. I think Berlusconi is kind of a good example in that, you know, he's a Marmite politician. People either seem to love him or hate him. So he said he's going to root out corruption within the political system. He is more open to Russia, or perhaps less unfriendly with Russia. I wouldn't say that he's necessarily a huge Russia file, but definitely more open. He's Eurosceptic, not in that he wants to take Poland out of the European Union, not in even that he opposes the European Union on principle or that he's against things like a European army, but like so many other leaders in Eastern Europe, he's against the kind of liberal elite that sit at the top of the European Union right now. And so he's, again, another one of those that wants to stand up to them and that talks a lot then about standing up to Brussels and this kind of thing. And again, he's in there presenting himself as an anti-establishment figure, an outsider. He's also one of the Czech Republic's richest men as well. So people have compared him to Donald Trump for a lot of that reason. You know, same kind of philosophy and then same kind of background. Now, Babiš himself has kind of gone backwards and forwards on whether he likes to compare himself to Donald Trump. I think he has kind of repudiated that comparison and he's appealed to it. So like all comparisons, it's not entirely accurate, but it contains some truth.
All right. Well, this we have an article up on the Trumpet website, Czech Republic's New Strongman, Yet Another King Rising. This by Josue Michels, our Trumpet writer who covers a lot of issues regarding Europe. And he quotes a co-worker letter from Herbert W. Armstrong back in 1980 talking about Czechoslovakia's role in the prophecies related to Europe. Can you just kind of put this in prophetic context for us?
Yeah, so we've got a couple of prophecies that he draws attention to. One is that Mr. Armstrong for a long time said that Czechoslovakia, as it was back then, would probably be part of this 10-nation superpower in Europe, which back when he was making those forecasts, he quotes in this article from the 1980s, that was a big deal because, you know, the Czech Republic Czechoslovakia got squashed by the Soviet Union. They were, you know, firmly under Russia's control. So for them to be part of this independent European superpower was a big deal. But Mr. Armstrong for years said, well, look, the prophecy says that it's going to be made up of nations from Western Europe, nations from Eastern Europe, and it seems very likely that Czechoslovakia could be one of those Eastern European powers. And then the other prophecy that he draws attention to is the one that we've talked about a fair bit on this program, which is that forecast in Revelation 17 about there being 10 kings that would rise up in Europe. And it says that it uses the term kings. We've drawn attention to the fact that they're probably going to be autocratic rulers. They're not going to be democrats. And you see these kind of rise in leaders with more autocratic leanings in Eastern Europe. It talks about them all having one mind and working together. You're seeing now this whole cadre of similar leaders there. And so you're seeing him arrive at the St. Babish, you're seeing Kurz, Orban, several of these leaders now that could well be some of these 10 kings arriving on the scene. And if they're not, well, at least they demonstrate the same tendency for Europe to look to these king-type leaders. And this is something as well that Trumpet editor or executive editor Stephen Flurry gave a whole show about earlier in the week called Germany and the 10 Kings, drawing attention to Kurz especially, but this whole trend in Eastern Europe. So he talked about it more on there. We've got our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, that lays out in detail and goes over what the Bible says is coming for this power that's building in Europe. And then we have our free booklet, He Was Right, that really goes into great detail about those prophecies Mr. Armstrong made about this coming European power. So we've got a lot of resources, a lot of material on what's going on in Europe right now.
Electrifying stuff. We appreciate that, Richard, very much. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. This morning, Stephen Flurry gave an excellent program on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show about the fall of ISIS and the rise of Iran, following up on another story we covered on Wednesday's program, how Iran has scored a significant victory at America's expense in northern Iraq by bringing the Kurds to heel with their recent independence bid. It's just a stunning vindication of the accuracy of biblical prophecy. Mr. Flurry played several clips of Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry saying, "Don't be distracted by ISIS. Keep your eyes on Iran. That's the king of the South." And we're seeing just how right he was. This next story underlines that same prophecy, showing why it's Iran we need to watch as the king of the South. And it regards some recent statements made by another major power in the region, Saudi Arabia. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, we had this really interesting interview that took place this week with the crown prince of Saudi Arabia with The Guardian. And he came out and said that the extremist version of Islam that many in his kingdom for the past 30 years have been following is outdated. And we want to remove ourselves, the government, as far from that as we can. He said now is the time to get rid of it, speaking about this extremist form of Islam. And this is interesting because Saudi Arabia has supported a lot of extremist groups, a lot of jihadi groups. Al-Qaeda obviously did take refuge in Saudi Arabia, was nourished in Saudi Arabia for a number of years. They've supported Jabhat al-Nusra in Lebanon and also in Syria. A number of Syrian groups have been funded and supported by the Saudi Arabian government. Now it seems if the crown prince is holding true to his word, or at least he wants this to happen, he's saying it's time to move on from that. He talked about this being an aberration in Saudi Arabia's history. He said it was basically a reaction to the Iranian Shiite theocracy that took over in 1979 when the Shah was ousted there, that because the Shiites now had their theocracy, that Saudi Arabia, many in Saudi Arabia decided that they needed to do the same thing. But he said, now we're turning over a new leaf and we're going to get rid of those extremist ideologies from our kingdom.
That's quite amazing. What do you expect to happen as a result of this? It seems like this. First of all, obviously, there's the obvious point that I made in just setting this up, that this does really set a strong relief between what the role that Saudi Arabia plays in the region and that of Iran. But let's just focus on Saudi Arabia for a moment. How does this change its foreign policy, the way that it conducts its business going forward?
Well, definitely, they are looking at dollars and cents here. They sense that their economy is based purely on oil, and that is going to run out at some point. So they need to modernize, and modernization and capitalism is what's needed there. And so they are going to have to restrict or change some of their laws. They've already basically said that a lot of their religious police are going to be reined in to allow different freedoms that weren't around before. Women obviously got the chance to drive for the first time in Saudi Arabia. I think it was a month or two ago. So they are making moves to open up Saudi Arabia to more, well, away from the strictest version of Islam. So this is probably a monetary thing. It's also going to open Saudi Arabia up to alliances that would have been more unsavory had they maintained their extremist views. For example, a relationship with Europe, an alliance with Europe becomes much more or something that would be easier to handle for European nations if Saudi Arabia is on the way out of radical Islam. If they've declared that they want to abolish that, then alliances with Europe could really be strengthened, and with the United States as well. And that is
just from a prophetic standpoint, the relationship with Europe is definitely the one that we would be most interested in.
For sure. And we could see that really taking off here in the next few years, or even straight away, especially as Iran obviously paints itself, or obviously is now the chief. Obviously, they've been the chief sponsor of terrorism, but now they are the choice. They are. If you're a radical Islamist and you want state sponsorship, who are you going to get your funds from? Where are you going to get it from? It does make Iran's draw for all of those Sunni fighters a much more, well, basically their only alternative. They're not going to get support from anywhere else. So it is going to build up Iran's credibility as the only benefactor for Islamic revolution throughout the world. And so, as I said, it's going to allow Saudi Arabia to then receive support in that fight against Iran, but it's also going to bolster Iran's numbers as well. While Iran obviously is a Shiite nation, they have always said they're not picky. They want to lead all Muslims, regardless of stripe, towards exporting that revolution. And this is only going to increase their draw.
We've got to write this up, Brent. It would be great to it'd be great to just go back and grab all of those statements from Gerald Flory, where he just said over and over, Iran is the king of the South. They are going to be the banner around which all of the radical forces in the region rally. Saudi Arabia taking this position, it just strengthened. Not that it wasn't clear before, but this just puts it beyond all doubt, in exactly as you said, in the minds of every single person in the region who says that any sort of dealings of a Muslim state with the West is, you know, courting the infidel and that type of thing, they're going to go to Iran's side that much more. There's a lot of knock-on effects from this that it would be worth exploring in a longer article. We do appreciate that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Let's step away from the geopolitical news for a moment and look at a social trend in America. The undermining of traditional masculine roles has been going on for several decades now, but it's taking a seriously dark turn as men are taking classes aimed at essentially reprogramming them so they unlearn what is being termed toxic masculinity. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is quite a shocking story. It's something that a Trumplet columnist, Brad McDonald, shared the link with me earlier this week about this class. It's a joint effort between the Rape Crisis Center and the Collective Action for Safe Spaces to offer a class called Rethink Masculinity. And this is just the latest of many classes that have been popping up in universities across the United States, basically doing just what it says, is like encouraging men to rethink their masculinity. And as you mentioned before, a trend several decades long that if you're the type of guy who is wanting to sign up to a class encouraging you to rethink your masculinity. You've obviously been having some doubts about this for some time, but it's something that basically especially after like the Harvey Weinstein sexual harassment scandal, it's basically blaming some of this, what they call rape culture or some of these sexual harassment scandals, on the traditional Judeo-Christian notion of gender roles. In particular, this class says that these type of sexual harassments occur when men try to suppress their feminine side, what occurs when they try to suppress their emotions, when they believe like a moral or religious paradigm that encourages men to lead women or to be aggressive. And that's the type of things that they're saying lead to the things that happened like in Hollywood last week.
Okay, that's completely bogus. So they're criticizing biblical masculinity because it leads to rape culture and that type of thing, when in actuality, the biblical masculine role is one of a protector of women and children, a defender of women and children, and it's very pro controlling your own lusts, and it's against adultery, and it's against promiscuity, it's for family. That's quite an amazing conclusion for them to draw from these recent events.
Well, it does show just how little the teachers of classes like this know about biblical masculinity. And like you said, that it's the seventh commandment is specifically against adultery and fornication. It's Jesus Christ who said that even thinking those type of thoughts is wrong. And there's plenty of other scriptures that really talk about how men should protect and lead and defend their wives and their daughters and sisters. I even saw a conservative commentator even making the case that in something like the Harvey Weinstein scandal is actually more of a condemning of how little masculinity there is in Hollywood these days, and the fact that most of these actresses that have come forward with allegations of sexual harassment, I mean, most of them had fathers and brothers and husbands or boyfriends. And I guess there was one report that maybe Brad Pitt said something to Harvey Weinstein about, please don't sexually harass my girlfriend anymore. But in pretty much every other case, none of these men seem to have any inclination to step forward or do anything, as long as their girlfriend got a good acting role and maybe a raise out of this deal. Yeah, it's just showing that just how little masculinity there was to stop things like this.
Right.
And now they're encouraging classes that are actually still leading into this idea that it's benevolent sexism, as they call it, to want to protect or defend the women in your life, which is just actually making things like this happen more frequently instead of less frequently. So they've actually taken to the cause of the problem and assigned it as the cure.
That is some extraordinary mental gymnastics to look at the Hollywood culture, Harvey Weinstein, all of this nonsense that's going on, and somehow pin the blame on biblical masculinity. In a sense, I can understand this idea that the way that men have behaved traditionally, obviously what's happening with Harvey Weinstein and all of the rape culture, this has gone on for some time to some degree or another. Hollywood's probably been one of the more prevalent cases where that's been going on, but it has really been the breakdown in the understanding of what the way that men should behave and the biblical morality that helped men to fulfill roles in holding society together and keeping those forces in check that have created this widespread problem. Quite extraordinary. If you wanted to give people more information on this subject, or to help them to understand biblical masculinity, where would you send them?
Right. Well, just the fact that these classes are being offered show that there's obviously a lot of misunderstanding about what the Bible says about masculinity. And it just so happens, just within the past several months, you've actually published an ebook entitled Biblical Manhood that goes through a number of pages, actually specific chapters on how to be a protector, how to be a provider, how to be a leader, that any of our listeners can access online at thetrumpet.com, that will go through in great detail exactly what the Bible really says about what it means to be a real man.
All right, we appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about Iran's continued push into Israel. And we have a few stories about Russia's increasing influence in world events in Asia, in Europe, and even in the United States. All this and more when we come back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in an earlier segment about Iran's dominance in the Middle East. One place where it is pushing is within Israel, specifically in Palestinian politics, which are at a crossroads right now. This past week, a high-ranking delegation from Hamas was visiting the Iranian capital to talk about these recent efforts that we've spoken about to reconcile with the rival Palestinian faction Fatah. So Iran is right in the mix here. And for this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
We've been speaking about this reconciliation deal for the past couple of weeks, as you said, between Hamas and Fatah. And really what we hadn't seen too much was what Iran thought about it, because obviously over the past few months, we've written on the website how much Iran is getting more fully invested in with its old proxy Hamas. They've restored their relationship back to how it was before the Syrian civil war. And so what are they thinking about it? Well, as you said, we've had Hamas make a number of trips. About 3 months ago in August, there was a trip by a senior delegation of Hamas to Tehran, where they talked about their continued relationship. And then this latest one over the past weekend to talk about what Iran is thinking about the reconciliation deal. And basically the word out of Tehran is that Iran definitely supports Hamas 100%, except the fact that it wants Hamas to continue to maintain its powerful army, its 25,000 strong men. It does not want it to give up any of its arms, does not want it to hand over its arms to Fatah or to the PLO. It wants to ensure that Hamas is able to continue to be the affront to Israel that it has been for so many years. So they received a lot of vocal support from different Iranian leaders. They met with the Speaker of the House, Larijani. They also met with a couple of advisors to the Ayatollah himself, an advisor to the foreign minister as well. So they received a lot of praise and support from Iran to maintain its strong army and not give anything away to Fatah.
This is amazing. This is absolutely amazing to see Iran so intricately involved with Hamas, and Hamas going to Iran and seeking counsel and getting advice and trying to getting Iran so involved in this, just as all of these efforts are taking place to try to bring Hamas and Fatah together that could have a significant impact, really change the entire landscape of Palestinian politics from what it's been for a decade. For Iran to be so deeply in the mix, that's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it's extraordinary in a sense, because we haven't seen that before. I mean, we know that they've supported Hamas for a number of years in its fight against Israel. And yet here we are in the middle of reconciliation talks. The world is kind of hopeful that maybe there could be something that comes of it. They've gone further in these talks than they've done in the past decade already. So maybe it'll be hopeful. And yet what Iran's doing is it looks to be jeopardizing those talks, just because one of the red lines for the Netanyahu government and actually dealing with the Palestinians is that if there is a reconciliation, basically the Palestinian groups that come together, Fatah and Hamas, they must recognize Israel. They must all the weaponry of Hamas must be given up, and Iran or Hamas must declare itself independent from Iran, that they're not going to take orders from Iran. That's what the Israeli position is. And yet it's like what Hamas is doing right now is saying, okay, whatever you think, this is the way we're doing it. We don't mind getting together with Fatah, but we're maintaining our relationship with Iran. Even Egypt, who's actually mediating these talks, is upset by this. They're the ones that have quite a lot of leverage over Gaza, over Hamas in Gaza, because they maintain the main transit point for goods coming in and out of Gaza, the Rafah crossing there across into Egypt. So they can really decide to constrict the economy in Gaza or to let it flow. And so using that leverage, they've brought Hamas to the table, and now Hamas is saying, well, whatever you think, Egypt, we actually – you might not have as much leverage over us as you think, because we have this other power. We have Iran that's willing to back us financially. Mm-hmm. We have Iran that's willing to even support us politically. So I don't know if this is going – it looks like this is going to jeopardize the reconciliation talks.
Well, what would Fatah's response to this be? I mean, it seems like they would be they would certainly take a very close interest in just how involved Iran would be.
For sure. They are fully aware of what Iran's wanted to do. Even if we go back a few months back into July when we talk about the when we talked about the Temple Mount crisis, when you saw this Palestinian uprising that in part was motivated by Iran, you had Fatah leaders coming out and saying that Iran is trying to meddle in Palestinian politics and they don't like it. They don't like it. Abbas doesn't want Iran involved because that, you know, it'll weaken his rule as well. So they're absolutely against this as well. But this hasn't busted up the talks.
Well, yeah. What other options do they have?
Yeah, this is surprising to me. I would have thought, given this just an absolute affront to this reconciliation deal. That's what I mean. The timing of Hamas and this huge delegation going to Iran in the middle of while this deal is going through is their declaration, Iran comes first. Mm-hmm. Iran comes first, and we are not giving up their support. We're not giving up our fighters. We're going to hold on to them. We're going to hold on to our weaponry. We're happy to deal with you. We're happy to reconcile, but those are our red lines.
So
how it moves forward from here, I don't know.
Well, remind us of just what Gerald Flory has said about Iran's influence on Palestinian politics and why this you could see this playing out in the way that he said that what we would expect to see happen within Israel.
Right. So we're expecting a few things. We are expecting Hamas to just gain more control, especially in the West Bank region where they haven't had much control. That's ruled over by Fatah. But we are expecting a Hamas takeover of the West Bank supported by Iran, because Iran's goal, as we've talked about in the show, has always been Jerusalem. Mr. Flory's written that a number of times. The King of the South booklet talks about that. Jerusalem and Prophecy goes into more detail about how that might happen. And the Iranians themselves always declare that as their goal. Even the senior Iranian politician, Ali Velayati, when Hamas was just this past weekend in Iran, this is what he said. He said the Palestinian cause is the most important cause of the Islamic world. This is the most important cause to us. And you're our number one proxy. We're going to support you in any way we can. So we're only looking for this relationship to increase, at least to the point that Hamas is able to really put pressure on Israel from inside the West Bank. And it doesn't look like at that point that Fatah is going to have a real say in it.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about here. I'm sure that we're going to be following this story. Maybe we could do a segment about it in a future program. But Jerusalem and Prophecy, certainly one resource that would give people the big overview of what we can expect to see happen here. We appreciate that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. A few stories about Russia next. We're going to start with a story about links between Russia and Germany. The German president just visited Russia, but this isn't exactly a return to warm relations between these two countries. Trumpet has kept a close eye on this relationship for many years. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is a very significant change with this vision. Deutsche Welle titled their article on the subject, New Chapter in German-Russia Ties. It's kind of traditional for Germany's president to visit Russia, to kind of play a quote-unquote courtesy call. But in the aftermath of Ukraine and everything going on there, Germany elected a very anti-Russian president in Joachim Gauck. And so he didn't visit. He only met Putin once in Paris. But now Germany's got a different president, and so, or has for a little while. And so he's made his first visit, or the first visit of a German president to Russia in 7 years. That's Frank-Walter Steinmeier. And he's made this visit. Now, I think this is something that's very important to pay attention to, because we had on Monday an article earlier in the week from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry talking about Germany and the anti-American attitudes building in Germany right now, some of the comments made by German politicians in the election against America, and this kind of really almost hatred of America that's building among a lot of people within Germany. Now, realistically, Germany would have a very hard time being really anti-German, anti-American, and really anti-Russian at the same time. It's kind of, you know, it's got to be close to or at least have a decent working relationship with one of those two powers. And so you see Germany now warming up to Russia at the same time that they're becoming more and more independent from the United States. And that's part of the reason why Mr. Flurry, and then long before him, Herbert W. Armstrong, forecast this building, that Germany and Russia would build this closer relationship. And so now we could be seeing that really accelerating after a lot of frosty time between Germany and Russia. We had an article in our April Trumpet magazine that you can read for more on this, called The Russian Alliance You Really Have to Worry About. We'll Trumpet a link to that below in the notes for the show, so you can go and learn more about what the Bible says and what these two men have been forecasting about this relationship.
All right, excellent. We'll move right into our next Russia story here. Russia is strengthening ties with the Philippines by selling and even donating military gear to this Asian nation. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Tuesday, Russia and the Philippines signed two major military pacts. One of these was a weapons deal, and the other one was the signing of the Russia-Philippines Agreement for Military Technical Cooperation. So these are deals that there's not yet been much publicly disclosed information about, but they will help both sides to further establish the framework that they need to just continue to make progress on deepening their defense ties. So that was Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, Russia surprised the Philippines with a gift of 5,000 AK-47 Kalashnikov assault rifles, 1 million rounds of ammunition, 20 military vehicles, and some other gear. And all of this was free of charge, courtesy of the Russian government. So it's a significant story, really, because it actually highlights three of the prophetically significant trends that the Trumpet is watching for. First is the decline of American power. The U.S. and the Philippines have been close allies for decades, and America has pumped a lot of money into that relationship. Just since the year 2000, the U.S. has donated $1 billion worth of military equipment to the Philippines. But now leaders in the Philippines see that the U.S. is declining, so they are preparing to abandon that sinking ship. And this trend was specifically prophesied in Leviticus 26:19, which says God would break the pride of America's power, and in other Bible passages. And then the second trend that this Russia-Philippines cooperation highlights is the coming together of what the Bible calls the kings of the East power block. Revelation 16:12 talks about this mighty Eastern bloc of Asian nations that will combine their resources together under Russia's leadership. Revelation 9:16 talks about it also. And when you see Russia giving a bunch of Kalashnikovs and state-of-the-art vehicles to weaker Asian nations, you can really see the groundwork being laid for this Asian Kings of the East bloc to come together. And then the third trend being fulfilled here is what you mentioned in the introduction to today's episode, and that is what the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. This is, Bible prophecy shows that these times will occur after a shift in global power takes place, pushing power away from America and Britain and then toward such nations as Russia, China, and Germany. So to see Asian nations like the Philippines pulling away from America and then tilting toward Russia shows that the world is entering into these times of the Gentiles.
All right. Outstanding. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Now to America, another Russia story, a story that Stephen Fleury covered in his Trumpet Daily radio show this week. Even as Democrats and the media have talked incessantly about Russia's ties with the Trump administration, major revelations continue to emerge about the Democratic Party's ties with Russia. It highlights what we at the Trumpet have called the real Russia scandal. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, a recent study had found that up to 20% of all U.S. news coverage about President Donald Trump has been speculation about his collusion with the Russians. And in kind of an ironic twist, it was revealed this week that actually one of the big stories on the Russian a Russian report that Trump had maybe had some connections with the Russians was actually financed by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Lawyer Mark Elias worked for the Clinton campaign and hired a company, Fusion GPS, to contact a former British intelligence agent named Christopher Steele to put together a report that's been widely debunked by now of just whatever dirt he could find on the Trump campaign with basically putting Christopher Steele's name on it, but not actually providing any other sources. And so now they're the Clinton campaign's being sued for violation of campaign finance laws by actually colluding with foreign intelligence firms and not disclosing the spending to try to dig up dirt on a domestic opponent, dirt that they haven't even been able to prove. And that is something that we've covered here at the Trumpet prophetically for a while, especially you mentioned in an article I'd written that can be found on our website entitled The Real Russia Scandal, which actually goes through some of the Bible prophecies from Hosea about America becoming or end time Israel becoming mixed up ideologically with foreigners and some of the Russian efforts to just basically sow chaos and division within the United States to pit American against American to the point where they're fighting with each other so much that they can't actually present a united front against a foreign power like Russia.
All right, we appreciate that. And I'm going to let you take the next story as well, Andrew. We're just a few days away from what has to be about the worst holiday all year in terms of overt evil anyway, Halloween. You're probably aware of the decline in religion in America, fewer people believing the Bible, going to church services, identifying with a mainstream church. Well, where are these people going? What do they believe? New information shows that, they're undertaking some pretty outrageous activity. For this, we'll go back to Andrew.
Right. This is actually a Market Watch report out this week showing that a majority of millennials believe that it's not necessary to have faith in God to be a moral person. A majority of millennials also believe that human beings came about as a result of evolution. And so you're asking yourself, okay, well, if you're believing in an evolution and you don't believe God's necessary to be moral, where are people looking for moral guidance? And this Market Watch report shows that up to 50% of U.S. millennials believe in astrology or regularly check their horoscope. And a much lesser but growing percent are also turning to religions like Wicca or paganism. It's said that witchcraft is actually the fastest growing religion in the United States. And at this point, it's probably the fastest growing religion because it's the smallest. There's only 200,000 registered witches in America, but they say that is a number that doubles every 30 months. Primarily drawing from younger millennial audiences that are already looking to the stars and their horoscope for moral guidance because they don't actually believe in traditional Christianity or even necessarily in God.
That's amazing. Is there anything that you would point people to for more information about this?
Right. Well, this is more of a general religious trend. But I mean, I guess if you are someone who's not proved the existence of God for yourself or who's ever had doubts as to whether or not there is a God, we do offer Herbert W. Armstrong's classic book, one of the 19 works that we won in court after a 7-year court battle to be able to bring back to you. Entitled Does God Exist, which we'll send to you free if you request it at thetrumpet.com.
Very good. We appreciate that, Andrew. We'll squeeze in one last item before we conclude. A quick update from Richard Palmer on the latest developments happening today in the Spanish region of Catalonia. Richard.
Yeah, a bit of a breaking update on the story we've been covering for the last couple of shows. The Catalan Parliament today just now voted to declare independence. Very quickly after that, the Spanish Senate voted to deprive the Catalonian regional government from just about all of their powers and to take over administering them centrally. So it's going to be very interesting to wait and see what happens. It wouldn't surprise me if the Catalan Parliament deliberately did this on a Friday so that everyone's off work for a weekend of protests, etc. So you could see this crisis in Europe continue to build, continue to escalate. And remember, Europe's traditional problem solver, Germany, is out of commission right now trying to figure out their leadership issues. So it's just yet another proof that Europe just needs to get its act together, get some strong leadership so it can deal with these crises that just keep popping up all over the place.
Well, glad we were able to fit that in. Thank you very much for that, Richard. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about today, to look at the program notes from today's show, and to get links to all of the literature and the articles that we referred to. You can give your feedback on the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, panel. Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure, as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Ben Franklin. I think the best way of doing good to the poor is not making them easy in poverty, but leading or driving them out of it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.